You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. The program you are about to hear is part of the Virginia Festival of the Book, held in Charlottesville, Virginia, from March 21st through 25th, 2012. The festival was sponsored by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. It was originally recorded in the City of Charlottesville Council Chambers by Charlottesville's TV 10.
I'm Bert Zisk, and I'd like to welcome you on behalf of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, which produces this annual Festival of the Book. Many thanks to the City Council for hosting this event, and I'd also like to thank the hundreds of volunteers who plan, staff, and promote the festival events. Please help us by filling out a program evaluation form and returning it to a volunteer as you leave. The program is being taped by Charlottesville Channel 10, and so please speak loudly and clearly when you're offered the mic before you make your questions. So hopefully you will have some questions. Today's program is one of our Celebrate 250 Charlottesville events, and it's called If Buildings Could Talk. These historic buildings are Monticello, Keswick Hall, and Grace Church. And no matter how many times you may have visited them, you'll be sure to learn something new and fascinating from these wonderful books. I'll introduce each author just before his or her presentation. Later in the session, you'll have a chance to ask questions and then to buy books and have them signed. And I must say, doesn't anybody go to lunch? I'll do this alphabetically. The first speaker will be Rick Britton, author of Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler, and he resides in Charlottesville. In addition to writing books and articles about Jefferson's Virginia, he is a historian, cartographer, lecturer, and tour operator, specializing in historic tours in Virginia. And if you want to know more about the Civil War, go see him. You're on.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Bert. It's a pleasure to be here. And thanks to all of you for coming. I was assuming, and you know what happens when you assume, but I was assuming that with Ed Ayers, one of the best speakers in the state of Virginia, just down the street at that luncheon, that maybe we'd have 20 or 30 people here. So thanks for all of y'all for coming. My book is Jefferson, a Monticello Sampler. It's a collection of 13 essays about different aspects of Jefferson's life. It's a sampler in the sense that it's not a running narrative. It's actually essays about different things that I was fascinated about. And it turns out, as I was doing these, I realized that what I'm interested in the most about Thomas Jefferson is what he was fascinated by. Now, that's a pretty broad topic, because if you know Thomas Jefferson, you realize one of the favorite quotes of his is, "No blade of grass grows uninterestingly to me." Jefferson was fascinated by everything. So to give you an idea about his interest that I included in here, here was a man who was fascinated by and loved wine, and one of the stories is about Filippo Mazzai and how Jefferson helped him establish the wine industry right here. Of course, it failed initially, but now it's thriving. He was fascinated by science, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment, all branches of science, but especially paleontology and archaeology. One of his great loves and his great interests was the American West. A lot of people actually call Thomas Jefferson the father of the West, not just because of his authorship, his pushing out of the Lewis and Clark expedition, but also because of his visions for the West and how he foresaw our country growing. So then I found an expedition. Not many people know this, but there was an expedition that was larger and more expensive than the Lewis and Clark expedition that went up the Red River. Everybody has forgotten about that, so I decided to write an essay, a chapter on that. That's the Freeman and Custis expedition. Jefferson, of course, was a big proponent of public education, so I had to include an entire chapter on his founding of the University of Virginia, one of his great gifts to our local area here and what it's done for our local economy. Imagine Charlottesville without the University of Virginia. It's kind of hard to imagine. And then, of course, a lot of people think that Jefferson only designed Monticello and the original grounds of the University of Virginia. But no, surprise, surprise, literally dozens of other structures he had an influence on. He either personally designed or helped with the design. So I had to devote an entire chapter to those. If buildings could talk is a perfect topic, and maybe I'll do an essay in the future about this, when you think about Monticello. Because Jefferson was involved, so involved, in every single detail of the design of Monticello, and not just the structure itself, but how it was decorated, how the rooms were furnished, the mountaintop itself, the gardens along the mountaintop. Because he was so meticulously involved in every detail, Monticello, not just the home, but the mountaintop, is a perfect reflection of who this man was and all of his interests. For example, he was fascinated with classical architecture, the architecture of Greece and Rome. Andrea Palladio was his great architectural mentor, a much earlier Italian architect. What Palladio had done is he had traveled all over Western Europe and sketched with measurements all of the extant ruins of the Roman world. So if you wanted to reproduce those classical styles in all of their exact forms, you got his four books on architecture. Mr. Jefferson called Palladio's four books on architecture the Bible when it came to building classical designs. He was fascinated with innovative design. What I just talked about refers to Monticello I, the first version that went up. Of course, the one that we know today is Monticello II. He was our minister plenipotentiary to France for a number of years after the American Revolution, and what he saw there was a lot of innovative designs in architecture, so that when he came back, he put a lot of them into Monticello. The one that comes to mind first, although this is not necessarily the most important, is indoor water closets. Hardly any other homes anywhere in Virginia had indoor toilets. No plumbing, but indoor toilets, and I'll say no more about that. He added an all-weather passageway, which made a lot of people early on in these crazy histories that they wrote of Monticello say that he had secret passages built into Monticello. It wasn't a secret to anybody. It was a passageway underneath the house. And he added that dome room, which made people, after his death for 50 years or so, try to imagine what in the world was the purpose of this dome room at Monticello. People wrote that, oh, Mr. Jefferson played billiards up there. That's a nice story, but unfortunately, Mr. Jefferson didn't play billiards. People thought that it was a ballroom on top of Monticello. And if you've ever been, and now more can go because they've opened it up to everybody, really, you just pay more money, but a lot of people have gone. Have most of you all been to the dome room? If you're up there, the dome is so small, unlike the dome at the Rotunda, that acoustically, it's horrible. So you can't play minuets. You can't play music up there. The stuff bounces off too quickly, and you would soon have cacophony. For a while, it was used as a bedroom for one of the granddaughters who was newly married. But nowadays, the architectural historians tell us that Mr. Jefferson's dome room was an architectural conceit. He put it on top of his house because it looked nice from the outside. And of course, it's the only such home with a dome on top of it in the United States. He was interested in conveniences, and he was fascinated with gadgetry, thingamabobs. So he packed his house with all kinds of newfangled devices. For example, the revolving serving door that he had probably seen someplace in Europe. The wine bottle dumbwaiter, the spherical sundial that's out on the West Terrace. That's actually not a new thing. That goes all the way back to the Greeks. It was 2,000 years old. Automatic double doors so that when you open one side, I'm sure you all have seen this on the tour, the other side moves simultaneously. The great plantation clock with the disappearing Saturday beneath the floor because he ran out of room. One of the things that fascinated me about all these gadgets is if you look on the internet and you Google Thomas Jefferson's inventions, people claim today that he created from whole cloth, invented all of these things. And actually, if you search a little bit harder, and I wrote about this, you'll discover that not one single item of these that I've mentioned and many more did Jefferson actually invent. He just packed the house with all these things that he thought were nifty little items, thingamabobs, and labor-saving conveniences. He loved science. He helped found a few. And, of course, that entrance hall is packed, and it was packed even more originally. They've had to take out tables that sat through the very center that were piled with all kinds of geological specimens. But one of the great things that they've left in there now that they have there today are the upper and lower jaw bones of the American mastodon. Mr. Jefferson was actually one of the founders of the science of North American vertebrate paleontology. They've also got quite a few Native American items in that entrance hall, Mr. Jefferson, because of a Native American burial mound from the Monacan Indian Nation that was located about 5 miles north of here that he excavated and wrote about in Notes on the State of Virginia. Because of that excavation, he's considered the father of modern archaeology. So again, because of his attention to detail and the way he packed the house, Monticello is a perfect reflection of Mr. Jefferson. I thought in what we could read, and we can read a little bit, right? And you're going to let me know when I run out of time, right, Bert? I looked for something. I wanted to read a few short passages rather than one long passage. And then I realized just yesterday that for some reason I've written a lot about arrivals at Monticello. Maybe this is because this is a reflection of the 450,000 people that arrive at Monticello every year nowadays. It used to be 600,000. Now it's about 450,000 a year. But also it's a reflection of how important Monticello was over the ages to different people, and Mr. Jefferson, how important he was. This first one is on Filippo Mazzei. Upon arriving in Virginia, Filippo Mazzei and his laborers passed a brief period at the home of Francis Epps, Thomas Jefferson's brother-in-law. Soon thereafter, in late November of 1773, so this is before the Revolution, Mazzei set out for the Shenandoah Valley together with Adams, whom the Tuscan called my mentor. Adams wished to see where it would be best to have his house built, wrote Mazzei, and I to find whether I could buy some land near him if I liked the location. It was unfortunate for these plans, however, that they stopped for an evening at Monticello. Remember, they were going to the valley, and then they stopped at Monticello. The next morning, as was his custom, the 30-year-old Thomas Jefferson arose early. Perhaps he was surprised to find Mazzei also up and about. Excited about hosting a European visitor, Jefferson took him on one of his long rambles and showed off the advantages of the neighborhood. When the two, already now fast friends, returned from their excursion, Adams, glancing at Jefferson, said, "I see it on your face that you've taken him away from me. Why? I just about expected as much." It had all been decided in a twinkling. The land on the southeastern slopes of Monticello Mountain seemed perfect for Mazzei's wines, and some of it could be acquired from a poor farmer. Plus, as Jefferson's property was adjacent and he had much more than he needed, remembered Mazzei, he made me a gift of a tract of 2,000 acres. Boy, those were the days, huh? Within a short time, a dozen other Italians arrived, and to their delight, the tall, friendly Virginian talked with them in Tuscan, which he had picked up unaided. Thus was introduced into Albemarle County Italian wine and vegetables, along with the distinctive tools the laborers had brought for their cultivation, spades and billhooks in particular, and their unique short game jacket or hunting coat. Thus, too, was begun a friendship that would endure 43 years. This next arrival at Monticello is not a welcomed arrival. It's the arrival of a squad of British dragoons under a Captain McLeod. To nab Jefferson at Monticello, Tarleton detached a Captain McLeod and a party of dragoons. As the horsemen ascended the little mountain, they encountered no opposition. By this time, however, Jefferson had not only observed the enemy in Charlottesville with a telescope, but had been warned again of their approach. Captain Christopher Hudson was on his way that day to join Lafayette's army. He was mistakenly told by a Mr. Long that Jefferson was unaware of the approaching enemy. Hudson later wrote that he galloped to Monticello, where I found Mr. Jefferson perfectly tranquil and undisturbed. At the captain's earnest request, however, Jefferson left his house. Not 10 minutes later, McLeod and his men broke through the trees into the clearing that surrounded the mountaintop villa. At almost the last possible moment, Jefferson had sent for his mount. The blacksmith brought up the horse at a trot, and Jefferson rode off to catch up with his family. He'd sent them off earlier. The roads were unsafe, he reasoned, so he rode first up over Carter's Mountain. From the heights, he looked back at Monticello in the agony that he would return only to a pile of ashes. He was leaving behind his home, his position as executive of the state, as governor, and perhaps what little dignity remained to him as a public figure. That evening, he joined his family at Blenheim for what must surely have been a horribly gloomy dinner. The fates pursued Jefferson into the depths of the forest, and the feeble government collapsed under the blows of the enemy. One more I want to read, and this one is a really famous visit. It's by the Marquis de Lafayette. As the grand procession descended the hill across from the Rivanna River town of Milton, the lead cavalry horses noisily began splashing into the ford. Startled birds flapped into the air and fluttered to the south over Monticello. Work was temporarily halted at Milton as the inhabitants rushed to the right bank. It was the early afternoon of November 4th, 1824. Behind the trim cavalry detachment rode the gaudily dressed committee of arrangements. Their high hats and black tails bobbed about as their mounts high-stepped through the chilly water. When the well-appointed four-horse landau eased across the Rivanna, closely followed by a motley array of mounted citizens, the crowd on the south shore got its first glimpse of the hero of two worlds riding inside. Here, just as everywhere else along his route, the spectator shouted greetings to this old friend of the young republic. Several miles after passing the river, the long procession slowly ascended Monticello Mountain. A loud bugle sounded when the lead cavalryman broke through the ring of trees north of the house. As the final notes echoed over the southwest mountains, the large crowd that had assembled at an early hour formed along the yard's western margin. The saber-wielding troopers jangled onto the yard and ranged themselves on the opposite side. All eyes followed the general's carriage as it wheeled to a halt at the gate leading to Monticello's east portico. Solemn quiet reigned as Lafayette alit. From the base of the portico steps, a feeble Thomas Jefferson, enveloped in a long coat against the chill, tottered forward to greet Lafayette. As the two old revolutionaries drew near, emotions overcame them both. To the obvious, 35 years had passed since they had last seen each other. To the obvious delight of the crowd, they embraced over and over. "God bless you, General," uttered the author of the Declaration of Independence. "Bless you, my dear Jefferson," came the reply. Do I have a couple more minutes?
No.
No, okay. Thank you.
Sorry to cut you off there.
No, it's perfect.
Patricia Castelli works at Keswick Hall, where questions from many guests inspired this book. Keswick was an estate that became a country club and is now a world-class hotel. Research, including newspaper and newsletter articles, as well as many individual interviews, made this a 3-year independent project. Patricia has 5 children and lives in Keswick, where she enjoys the view of the Southwest Mountains from her home and plays tennis when she can. You're on.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming today. It's such a pleasure to be here and to share with you about a property that has fascinated me for a long time. And there's supposed to be a picture here. There we go. Okay, there we go. The title of this panel, If Buildings Could Talk, is wonderfully appropriate. I wrote the story of Keswick Hall because this building and this property was talking to me, and also was talking to a lot of other people who were asking me questions I couldn't answer. So that's how this came about. The first paragraph of my introduction reads, "In plain or fancy handwriting, guests of Keswick Hall have summed up their experiences using superlatives like fabulous, breathtaking, one of the nicest places on earth, exquisite, wonderfully elegant, spectacular, this is paradise, beyond belief, and simply the best. Surely, with past and present descriptors such as these, taken from the huge guest books on display in the entrance hall and a continual stream of comment cards, Keswick Hall must not only be an extraordinary, must-visit, will-be-back kind of place, it must also have a lot of interesting stories to tell. Walk the grounds, examine the architecture, touch the woodwork, listen for sounds of the past. The stories that weave together to create the property's collective cultural tapestry reach into its corners, up and down its stairs, in and among its gardens, and beyond its walls and boundary markers. The stories reach into the past and embrace the present." In other words, if buildings could talk, this one would have a lot to say. So just for fun, let's listen a bit. The original building was called Villa Crawford. It was built in 1912, 100 years ago. So we are happily celebrating our 100th anniversary at Keswick Hall. It was a private home for 35 years. This view is from the side, which is now part of the front. If this view could talk, I think it would say, "Look, same two chimneys, but I have changed." This view of the original building was actually the front, which is now the side. If this view could talk, I think it would say, "I haven't changed that much." Inside, not much has changed at all. This picture right here is from 1914. You can see the tiger rug on the floor and these giant urns from the original. This picture here is from the 1990s, when the Laura Ashley signature style prevailed. But not that much has changed. In 1949, if this building could talk, it would say, "Hey, now I'm a country club." There was an enormous pool. Oh, come on. There we go. All right. An enormous pool right here, two-story cabanas, nine-hole golf course out here, and three tennis courts up here. And a lot of people having a lot of fun. One of the best parts of this project was meeting so many people who have so many connections to this property over the years. That was just really great. Soon there was another pool. 10 tennis courts total, not 9 more holes of the golf course, and a lot going on. By the mid-70s, the building would be saying, "Hey, look at my nifty little air conditioning unit right here, and my very cool TV antenna. But where are all the people?" And by 1990, this building was saying, "We are in serious trouble here." But we all know this story has a happy ending. Keswick Hall, gorgeous, enchanting, and inviting. How did it get to be that way? People, of course, and what a cast of characters. I'm going to go back to the beginning and highlight just a few. First, Mrs. Crawford. These are hers, by the way. These are her silver beads. Nice. I'm very happy to have met the woman who knew Mrs. Crawford and let me borrow these. So, was she beautiful? Your call. But I can tell you this, her house turned into a spectacular property. People come to Keswick Hall for romantic getaways and weddings and receptions and all kinds of special occasions. Accolades abound. Awards abound. So if I were going to make up the story of this property, I would start with a fairy tale romance and turn it into a long-lasting love story. You would do the same, right? I mean, it would fit. So this part of the writing process was quite a disappointment to me. Mr. and Mrs. Crawford married in 1907. They had these sweet twin boys in 1910. moved into Villa Crawford in 1912. And in 1917, just 5 years later, Mr. Crawford legally conveyed the property to Mrs. Crawford and left. And if that weren't bad enough, when I was doing research, I was at the library downtown with my friend Rebecca Norden. I came across this article. Poor Mr. Crawford. He was found dead in his hotel room. So I said to Rebecca, I was so hoping for a good love story. And she said, not me. I was hoping for a murder. The fact is, Mrs. Crawford remarried 6 days after Mr. Crawford died. Whoa. You can't make this stuff up, but you can reach your own conclusions. Fast forward to 1947, Donald Stevens turned Villa Crawford into a country club after a series of private owners. Mr. Stevens said to his wife one day, according to his children, honey, how would you like a country club of your own? And thus began 42 years of country club life, on again, off again, open, closed, solvent, insolvent, but a lot of fun. 1951, this was a brochure for the swim ballet that took place to raise money for a high diving board. One sweet and genuine love story did come out of this, but you can read the story for yourself in the book. Some great weddings and wedding receptions. This is Betsy Lang in 1953, Debbie Gibbs with her husband Randy in 1967. Don't you love it? Check out the shoes, dyed to match. This is my favorite shot of that grand staircase. This wedding took place in 2010, and this is Cassie Connor coming down the stairs. Parties. Don't you want to know what they're talking about? I just want to read a little bit here. Dottie Reynolds, whose husband became the club's golf pro in 1966, recalls the monthly formal dinner dances with tuxedos required, the Friday night Scotch foursomes, and costume balls. She said, the year the contraceptive pill was introduced, we had one couple who came as the Pope and the pill. They won, of course. And great food. This was another really fun part of my research. I met John Gaines, whose father was the club chef during the late 40s and early 50s. And he and I were talking on his porch. He was telling me about his father and how proud he was. And then he said to me, wait, I have one more thing for you. And he got up slowly and went into his house and came back out with this menu and another one. And he had saved them from his father. I felt like I had treasures in my hands. Look, shrimp cocktail, $1. Filet mignon, $3.75. Wow. Don't you wish? Wow. So more parties. This one was taking place in the snooker room in late 60s. This is also late 60s. There was an ice skating rink on the patio of the large oval pool. And I would like to point out this cedar tree right here, which still stands. And tennis, lots and lots of tennis. Bob Reed was the tennis pro during that time. And Arthur Ashe even did an exhibition match at Keswick Club in 1969. Hmm. Lots of golf. And as you can see, we are at the height of fashion here as well. Golf tournaments, golf parties, and do you all see what I see? Keswick Club integrated in 1965. According to Bob Reed, who is the tennis pro, and I quote, this caused quite a hullabaloo. Membership dropped to 55 people in 1965. But soared to 808 by 1971. But things changed in 1971, and two quieter decades followed. During the 70s and 80s, the property had the requisite unsolved murder mystery, a bona fide Hollywood movie made right there. There's Alan Alda and Carol Burnett right in the Villa Crawford, and several downright failures. Thankfully, it also had a superhero. This is Sir Bernard Ashley, who's the widower of Laura Ashley. Yes, that Laura Ashley, the one with 220 shops around the world during the 70s and 80s, featuring a signature fashion and home decor style that made them many millions. These were exciting times. A Daily Progress article on December 8, 1990, entitled "Keswick Country Club is on the Mend," noted that the architectural firm Drown, Eichmann, Dalgleish, Gilpin, and Paxton had been hired by the Keswick Acquisition Corporation, and thus the tide came in. The Keswick Acquisition Corporation represented Ashley Inns, which happened to be owned by Sir Bernard Ashley, widower of Laura Ashley and head of the immense firm that they had built together. Winston Churchill did say, "Success is the ability to go from failure to failure without losing your enthusiasm." The property's life full of failures, as recounted in the Daily Progress in August of 1983, was about to see success. Its potential could not, would not, be denied. History had shown that at any given time, someone was envisioning its long-term viability. Someone was not giving up. This time, the someone had a personal fortune and an undeniable knack for getting things done. Here's B.A. with, or he was known as B.A., is Bernard Ashley. Here he is with Arnold Palmer, who redesigned the golf course in the early 1990s. This lady right here is Lady Regine Ashley. Laura Ashley herself had passed away in 1985, 5 years before Sir Bernard bought the property. Lady Regine was his second wife. Villa Crawford, may I remind you, was a shambles in 1990 when Sir Bernard Ashley bought it. The windows were boarded up. Plaster was falling, the retaining walls were cracking. Again from my book, Sir Bernard felt strongly that Villa Crawford itself held an important place in the overall scheme. It all flowed, Peter McDonough said. B.A.'s point was that everything was going to flow through Villa Crawford. It was important to him. That's why they seamed it instead of bulldozing it and spent probably 10 times the amount of money to save it. With the topiary garden and gazebo, a prime location for weddings, flowing out the portico to the north, where the Horizon Pool is now, and the new section of the hotel continuing as it does to the south, Villa Crawford's prominent position can be understood. The old extension to the south was too dilapidated and was therefore torn down, but the rest of the mansion was covered in plastic, covered in plastic for 4.5 months, 6 weeks to remove the asbestos that wrapped every pipe as a protection against freezing, and 3 more months to make sure there was no contamination. All that time, only authorized workers in hazmat suits were allowed in. But as with the golf course, much of the original integrity was maintained. Without a doubt, BA's directive ultimately allowed for a true 100-year anniversary and historic designation in 2012. Nevertheless, if Villa Crawford could talk during its renovation, I think it would say, "Ouch!" But then it would say, "Ah, that's more like it." This photo was taken before the Horizon Pool was put in. The pool changed the look a little and added yet another delightful feature. And here's Villa Crawford now. That's mist rising up off the heated pool on a cool morning. And from afar, I love this cedar tree. That's the same one I showed you earlier next to the ice skating rink. It's still there. It's a survivor, and it has watched over the comings and goings for a lot of years. So it got to be a part of the hotel's 100-year anniversary logo. Keswick Hall. What's it saying to you? Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. I just have to say, I hope you noticed the prices up there. Well, they were a lot higher when my birthday was just celebrated out there. I won't tell you how long ago that was. Barclay Reeves is author of A History of Grace Church. He is an Albemarle County native, and his writings focuses on horses as well as on local history and characters. Barclay also wrote the 100-year history of the Keswick Hunt Club, and his stories have appeared in numerous newspapers and magazines. He is a regular contributor to In and Around Horse Country and Virginia Sportsman.
Well, as Patricia just did so beautifully, I don't think the if has any place in the if buildings could talk. Buildings do talk, they say ouch and ah. Monticello speaks volumes, but Grace Church does as well. It is our happy lot as historians and writers to distill and interpret and then amplify those messages. I will try to be respectful of time because I heard someone speaking on the history of a church in for about 10 minutes, and to me it seemed about 9 minutes too long. Anyway, as Patricia talked about going and discovering somebody who has a menu, and Rick talking about you're researching and then you learn about this long lost expedition to the West. It is just very fulfilling. I don't think that any of us have gotten really rich from these efforts, but the personal satisfaction is immense. These daily discoveries, which are victories of, this long-lost letter. In the case of Grace Church, the building, there were letters from General John Hartwell Cock of Bremo to the people involved with the building of Grace Church about how you find a stonemason and how you go about this. And for Rick and maybe you, the University of Virginia, the small special collections library is just the most wonderful place in the world for producing things like this. Grace Church, as I was trying to assemble the history, one day there was a guy sitting in front of me in the church that I struck up a conversation, and he said, "Oh, you know, you're interested in writing the history. You do have a copy of all the colonial vestry minutes, don't you?" I said, "What?" He said, "Oh, they're available from Rosalie Davis of La Cherie Drive in Manchester, Missouri, and here's a copy, and you can have my copy. I'll get another." And it had all these proceedings from the 1740s, 1750s, even had information about Thomas Jefferson, who served on the vestry of the parish from 1767 until 1770, and then the reason he could no longer serve on the vestry was Shadwell burned, and so he moved across the Rivanna River to the place called Monticello, and that put him in a different Episcopal parish. Now, it's interesting that Thomas Jefferson was on the colonial vestry because he came to write the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which undid the civil power of the Anglican Church in Virginia, and it seems like a no-brainer, I hope, for us today that we do not live in a theocracy, that we are not obligated to pay tax to any particular church. But when Jefferson proposed this statute, he was very much opposed by several people, including our great patriot Patrick Henry, and some people called his statute for Virginia for Religious Freedom, which is on his gravestone as one of his three great accomplishments. They called it an emanation from the Antichrist, and another person said that the statute, Jefferson's statute, for Religious Freedom degrades Christianity to a level with the voluptuousness of Mohammed or the worship of Juggernaut, and comprehends within its protection the Jew and the Gentile, and the Mohammedan and the Hindu and infidel of every denomination. So people question what we're about. And it was with great pleasure that I have some portions of that statute in this book, that including that truth is great and will prevail if left to herself. I actually got that quote in some led there by an close reading of the history of Christ Episcopal Church in Charlottesville, a younger congregation that was for a while within the same parish as the parish that is now Grace Church. A former and in the early 1800s, preachers would preach at it was Walker's Church, the building that preceded the present stone edifice. They would preach there one Sunday, then they'd come to Charlottesville the following Sunday, then they'd go down to North Garden, or they'd go to Buck Mountain, or as the different configurations of the parish over the year, over the years, and in that history of Christ Episcopal Church, Charlottesville, the author is James Wooten, who is, are you in here? I have not met, but he included a report that at the time the preacher of the parish was Reverend Frederick Winslow Hatch. And Reverend Hatch, in his report in the early 1830s, he said, oh, the Charlottesville parish, they're excelling in zeal and piety. But he said the congregation of Walker's Parish is wanting in zeal and piety, and the neighborhood in general presents a dismal prospect. So I read that, and I said, this demands some sort of reply, and what struck me is, we are ostensibly two Christian institutions, and so a dagger or a cannon shot or a pistol shot on my part verbally would not have been appropriate. So I sort of I hope she's not from that congregation. I softened the blow, but she's not taking any chances. What I said, I presented the report by Reverend Hatch, as was quoted, and I said, we are grateful for Mr. Wooten and in his History of Christ Church for bringing this to us, for bringing our attention to this, because such gloomy and dismal appraisals of our area are so rare. I'll read a little portion here that got a few laughs a few years ago when I read it to a gathering later in the evening and cocktails had been flowing, so it may not work again. When I talk about the mint julep, this is a a reference to comments that were made by a wonderful man named Bernard Chamberlain. And does anybody know that? Anybody know Bernard? Well, Bernard was a delightful character, and it's a long story how I came to spend some pleasant afternoons conversing with him. But he would get apoplectic at the story that Jack Jewett, in his ride to Monticello in Charlottesville to warn of Tarleton's approach, that Thomas Walker delayed him with mint juleps, because Bernard, who was strict about, he was a great historian, but he was strict about getting things right, and he said the mint julep was had not been invented yet. It was invented later in Kentucky. Bernard also, he wrote an article once about the equestrian history of Albemarle County, and he started it out, Albemarle County has an enviable history. And I just love that, because I thought, there are all these other counties just jealously trying to put it over on Albemarle. But I realize I'm playing with fire, but to take the place of Christopher Clark, who resigned from the parish vestry in 1745, the vestry chose Dr. Thomas Walker. Dr. Walker, who lived from 1715 to 1794, was energetic, ambitious, and on his way to prominence. He was a good choice for the position. He served faithfully and diligently to the disestablishment of the Anglican Church in 1787. His name appears on countless indentures and processioning returns. He was often delegated to inspect the deteriorating conditions of the glebe and to supervise repairs. A few months before he was chosen to the vestry, Walker hosted divine services at his house. That house was Castle Hill, which he occupied by marrying in 1741 Mildred Thornton Merriweather, widow of Nicholas Merriweather. I tell who that is. This Nicholas was the grandson of the recipient of the huge land grant. Castle Hill and the thousands of acres that went with it were actually the property of Dr. Walker's stepdaughter, Mildred Merriweather. She married and died young, leaving a son, John Syme Jr., whose guardian Walker eventually paid £400 of current money to gain title to the property. Walker constructed in 1765 the frame portion of the house at Castle Hill, which still stands. The dwelling which preceded it stood near or on the present house site, because Walker's name, Walker's home is marked on the Jefferson Fry map in the area drawn in 1751. In 1750, Walker led a four-month expedition to Kentucky with five companions. They were not the first white men to reach there, but Walker was the first to write about the region and to map it. He set out in March, but made it back home in time to attend the fall vestry meeting. While away, he passed through and named the Cumberland Gap, explored the region, and killed numerous buffalo and bear. Another accomplishment of Walker's, leaving tangible evidence, was his founding of the city of Charlottesville. In 1762, the Virginia Assembly, General Assembly, conveyed the future city land to him to be sold for the benefit of Albemarle County. Additional accomplishments have been incorrectly attributed to Dr. Walker. Many have believed that he donated the land on which Grace Church now stands. He did not. His son sold the land to the parish. He did not develop the Walker strain of foxhounds, which are often mistakenly credited to him. Another story about Thomas Walker is that in 1781, he delayed Colonel Tarleton and his British troops at Castle Hill with mint juleps, allowing Thomas Jefferson and the legislature in Charlottesville to avoid capture. Tarleton did stop by Castle Hill during his raid. He was in a hurry, though, and covered 70 miles in 24 hours. Walker may have tried to stall him with some other tactics, but the mint julep was not invented until many, many years later, according to eminent cocktail historians. I pushed the envelope, but hopefully not too far.
Well, it gives a lot of things to think about and laugh about, and I thank them all three. But how about questions? Who's got a question? Don't tell me nobody has a question.
This is about Grace Church. You said that there is a second building, which I assume is the current building, which is very, very beautiful.
Correct.
What happened to the first building, and how did the second building get built?
Well, the first building was one of three similar structures. One was built in Louisa, one was built at the site of Grace Church, and one was built near the site of present-day Buck Mountain Church near Earliesville. And these were wooden frame structures. And so in the 1840s, it was decided that the wooden frame structure was not fancy enough to accommodate the growing population in the Keswick area. So the plans were made and solicited for the present stone edifice. And the story is that the old wooden structure was pulled down and was used, according to Meade's Historic Homes of the Southwest Mountains, it was found its way into a farm where a farmer used it for an irreligious purpose. And so I don't know, you know, how profane, and I don't know what farm, and I don't know where it is, and if you've got part of it. The interesting thing, Buck Mountain Church in Earliesville, it was moved west and then reassembled with some new ingredients. So it's not the original colonial church, but it has some of the wood that remains from the structure in the 1740s, and it's a great place to visit.
I'm a newcomer to Charlottesville. I've been here only 45 years. But when I first came here, Keswick had just been integrated, so-called, and the person who was the first black member was the Reverend Henry B. Mitchell of Trinity Episcopal Church. And I don't know if this is true, but maybe you do, and I've certainly held it as truth for all these years. One of the reasons for Keswick's decline was not simply the integration of the club, but that the state ABC board denied the petition of Keswick for a liquor license the day that Henry Mitchell teed off on the golf course.
What happened? Well, I actually heard that same story, and I spoke to a member of the board of directors at the time. And I said,
"Who was that?
What was his name? I'm sorry, that'll come to me." I said to him, "How could this be? Is it really true that the liquor license was pulled because of this?" And he just looked at me and said, "This is Virginia's sweetheart." I did not mention that particular thing in my book. No, I did not.
It's just about the most interesting thing in this book. It was the first integrated country club in Virginia.
She does mention the issue in the book, and you have a wonderful thing in your introduction, which is you heard, you say, "I heard many stories in compiling this book, and some of the stories I heard don't belong in a book." And I encountered the same sort of... But your statement of discretion is just so beautiful.
Thank you. I did have to be careful. So.
Oh, yes.
Concerning Keswick, I understand it has recently been purchased by someone else.
That's correct.
And I was wondering what the plans are for the Keswick Hall now.
I can't say I know what the plans are. I'm not sure anyone knows what the plans are. What I can say is that it's wonderful, and the future is very bright, and we're all very excited that Keswick is going to be even better than it was before.
Could Barclay speak just briefly about John Armstrong Challoner and the insurance policy and the walkway and where your parents, where your relatives are buried?
Thank you for that question. And it's a very interesting question, which and especially because among the many distinguished people in the room is our own great author Donna Lucy in the back there. And thank you. So it's lovely to see you, as always. Donna is the author of Archie and Amelie, Love and Madness in the Gilded Age, which I recommend. There, I see some nodding heads. Thank goodness. Donna did a wonderful job of researching both John Armstrong Challoner and his erstwhile wife, Amelie Reeves, who's a distant cousin of mine. John, this structure burned to the ground in 1895. I think it was February of 1895. And only a few months previously, a local eccentric philanthropist or philanthropic eccentric, take your pick, John Armstrong Challoner, who lived just about a mile from the church, he had, unbeknownst to everyone, taken an insurance policy out on the church. And when the church, which has through its life has always had furnace problems, including 3 weeks ago, the oil furnace went fluey and spewed oily soot over the entire structure, and the company that cleaned up after Hurricane Katrina had to be called in to take care of that. But John Armstrong Challoner's insurance policy enabled the church to be rebuilt very quickly. And so there is some, I think, reasonable debate over, well, did John Armstrong Challoner take out the insurance policy and then light a match? And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Donna assigns a few more percentage points of that being possible than I do. And I take my cue from the movie Body Heat with Kathleen Turner and William Hurt and Mickey Rourke. Anybody seen that? Where Mickey Rourke tells William Hurt, "Austin is a serious charge, counselor. You're a genius if you can think of 50% of the ways you can," I'm going to bracket, "mess up. And you ain't no genius, counselor." I don't think that he could have pulled it off in a neighborhood as garrulous as Keswick and as impossible to keep secrets. But it's not entirely impossible.
Thank you very much for bringing the great historian locally, Bernard Chamberlain, into focus. I also have lived here a long time, and he was as prominent and when I first moved here as the three of you are today about the histories, the local history. And thank you. Most people don't know how he was. Thank you.
I got a little question. Can you, one, tour the church in this day and age?
It will be open for Virginia Garden Week, which is, what, the second week in April?
Third
week in April. Come on down, or come at Sunday morning at 11 and lend your voice.
Okay. So you see that the church has an opportunity to speak for itself. Although with these three, those buildings do not have to speak. They have somebody to speak for them. And I want to congratulate them and thank them very much for what they've done.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.